Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are in Luke 18. I have been asked by several people whether I would comment on the passing of the Pope. I thought about it. There's been so much in the news and been so many outrageous things said. I will only point out that I am a Protestant and that I am an evangelical Protestant. The word evangelical has at its root evangel, good news. I believe in the good news, the gospel of salvation by grace through faith, without the works of the law or without the works of the church. I don't need any other intercessor or mediator between me and God. I heard a Catholic bishop yesterday say that it was appropriate for the Pope to die and go to heaven now because we need a mediator in heaven who can deal with and is familiar with the problems of the 21st century, implying that Jesus himself is not an adequate mediator or intercessor and that Jesus is now out of touch with the 21st century. Those kind of comments were just outrageous. I heard Rudy Giuliani last night talking to Brian Williams. Brian said, well, you knew him as a friend and as a leader of your church. I'm sure you'll miss him. And he said, no, now I can pray to him. I heard another bishop say that the Pope will bypass purgatory completely and go straight to Mary's side. And so I will only point out that I, being an evangelical Protestant, while I can appreciate the many good things that Pope John Paul II did on the world stage in Europe, the fall of communism, taking down the Berlin Wall, how instrumental he was in those things, he gives every indication of being a very positive, influential man and role model here on earth. However, having said all that, he has done more to promote Mariology and more to promote unbiblical heresy than any man in the 20th century. That won't make me popular for having said it, but it's absolutely true.
Sad to see big Christian leaders also.
Well, that's the point.
Who were on a lot of politics, who were involved in politics.
Exactly. Great big Christian leaders who have great big churches and great big budgets, who are also very politically motivated, needed to stay connected to him because they couldn't afford to offend a Catholic audience out there. And the world, by and large, is so biblically ignorant, and the world religions that are all based in good works all look at him and say, well, look at the many very large, very obvious good things he did. Therefore, he's a good man. Therefore, he's getting an express elevator to heaven. He never advanced the gospel of free and sovereign grace. He never preached or advanced the gospel of Christ's sufficiency in all things. The picture they kept showing last night over and over was the picture of him holding up that round wafer of the sun, holding up the host, wearing his fish hat. You can't help but look at those images and see Babylon all over the place. So there's my comment. My favorite comment so far about him comes from Janie Downs, who this morning said, the head of my church did not die this week. I like that comment. The head of my church died 2,000 years ago, got up 3 days later, and right now is sitting on the right hand of God in glory. And I don't need any other head of any other church. And Jesus said, call no man father after the flesh. You have one father, that is God. I refuse to think of any man as holy father, which even Protestant, evangelical, nominal Christian, atheist, agnostic broadcasters continued to call him holy father yesterday. It's just the absolute lack of anything that resembled biblical Christianity on the airwaves for the last 2 days is absolutely stunning. Luke 18 is where we're starting. Now we're going to hear from the one who died, who lives again, who is sitting on the right hand of God, the one who is the head of the church. And you know what? When the head of my church died, they didn't have to elect a new leader. He remained the leader, and he'll stay the leader. He's always been the leader, and I don't need any other leader.
Not to mention he chose his demise.
Yeah, I have the power to lay down my life. I have the power to take it up again. Quite different. The Pope got old, got decrepit, and died just like every other man, which is proof, by the way, that he was a sinner, because the wages of sin is death, and he died. So, Jesus spoke a parable unto them to this end, that men might always to pray and not to faint. So, what is the point of the parable we're about to read? To pray, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. This is the point of the parable. So whatever else you get out of this parable, the point is men ought always to pray and not to faint. Now, I'm going to tell you before we get into it, so that you understand as we go through it, this is within the context of Jesus heading toward Jerusalem, and you're going to see in the next several things that he talks about that there's a lot of murmur, a lot of talk going on now about whether the kingdom is going to come immediately. And he's going to tell them a couple of parables to readjust their thinking around the notion that the kingdom would come immediately. And he is sort of defending the notion that he is the Messiah that was to come, and the kingdom not arriving right now does not in any way diminish the fact that he is the Messiah, the Son of David, predicted to come. That's kind of the context. And remember that Israel at this point, the Jews that he's walking and talking among, are under Roman dominion, and they're looking for the kingdom to come to throw off the yoke of Rome and every other oppressive kingdom that has kept them down. So now that the Messiah is there, they're expecting him to rise up, create the kingdom, reestablish Israel, throw off the yoke of bondage. So there was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. The point of that being, this guy had no loyalty to anybody, didn't fear God, didn't care about any man or any man's power. He's going to call him an unjust judge in a few minutes. In other words, he pretty much did whatever he wanted to do. Verse 3, and there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him saying, avenge me of mine adversary. So that prayer, since Jesus chose what the particular prayer was going to be that this woman was going to bring to the unjust judge, he specifically made it, avenge me of my enemy, which is exactly what Israel was wanting. They wanted the Messiah to come and avenge them of their enemies, of Rome and of Greece and of Babylon and of Assyria and of Egypt and all the kingdoms that had ever oppressed them. They were looking forward to the Messiah coming and avenging them. Avenge me of my adversary, says this woman. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she wears me out or wearies me. So he's saying, even among human beings, you know this is true. He's taking something that's a human characteristic, and then he's going to compare it and apply it. He says, even among human beings, you could have a man who has no loyalty to anybody, who doesn't believe in God, who doesn't care about any man or any man's troubles. He can be an unjust judge, and yet if a woman was to come to him constantly, continually asking for justice, that even he eventually would say, even though I really don't care about anybody, I'm going to give this woman what she's asking for because she's just going to wear me out if I don't. It's the Simpsons bit of Bart and Homer going, no, quit it, no, ow, quit it, no, ow, quit it. Dad, can we go to the, no, dad, can we go to the, no, dad, can we go to the, no. I mean, every kid knows how to work that. It's the continual wearing down of somebody by repetitious asking for something. Okay, that's the point of the parable. Now he's going to apply it. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. He said, because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she wearies me. Hear what he said. And shall not God, who he's now contrasting to the unjust judge, an unjust judge will get wearied and eventually give you what you ask for. Will not God, who is holy, righteous, knows what you need? Shall not God avenge his own elect? Who are the elect in that statement?
The Jews.
The Jews, Israel. Israel nationally are the only elect known on planet Earth at the time that he is speaking this. This has nothing to do with the church. Church doesn't exist yet. There's been no death, burial, resurrection. The only elect on planet Earth at that time are Israel. So when he says, shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night to him, though he bear long with them. In other words, they are so anticipating that when the Messiah comes, he will set up the kingdom, that now they're wondering why it is that he, after 3.5 years of showing himself to be Messiah, doing these miracles, heading toward Jerusalem, they want to know, where is this kingdom? When are you going to set this kingdom up? And his answer to them is, God knows, God's listening, he's bearing long with you, but you know that he will avenge you. Because if an unjust judge will eventually respond to a woman who just keeps repeating and asking and wearing him out, won't God avenge his elect, those that he does love, those that he does care for? God, who does keep his promises, is going to keep his promises to his people whom he has chosen. So he is assuring these Israelites, it is going to happen, the kingdom is going to come, everything that's been promised to you is going to happen, you are going to be avenged of your enemies, but not yet. That's the continual message. Remember again, like I told you, the last question he's asked before he leaves planet Earth is, right, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? It's a very important last question, because even after the death, burial, and resurrection, they are still expecting the kingdom that's been promised to them all the way through the Old Testament. That promise has never dissipated. It's never gone away. So in this parable, he's making it clear to them that God will avenge them of their enemies. So keep praying, keep asking, keep expecting it is going to happen. Shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. What does your translation have there for speedily?
Quickly.
Quickly, yeah. Once he starts the tribulation and the avenging work, once it happens, it's all going to happen very quickly. I tell you that he will avenge them quickly. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Very interesting phrase. I have heard many, many, many preachers pull that out of its context and say, when Christ returns, will he find faith on the earth? As if it's up to you then to rev up your faith, to make sure you have some faith, to show Christ when he comes back. What sort of faith could Christ possibly be talking about at this moment? Is he talking about the saving faith in the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ?
No.
No, why not?
Because they were raptured.
Well, and it hasn't happened yet, right?
Right.
At the point that he's speaking, there's been no death, burial, and resurrection, right? So he's not saying faith in that. That mystery has yet to be revealed. In a minute, he's going to tell them, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be handed over to the Gentiles, I'm going to be beaten, mocked, scourged, spit on, die. And it even says, Luke takes the time to tell us, John takes the time to tell us, that they didn't understand what he was talking about. And John says it's because the Holy Spirit hadn't come yet. So they couldn't have faith in all those things. So when he says, when the Son of Man returns, shall he find faith on the earth? He cannot be talking about saving faith, because we know this. We know that when he comes back for his church, which is not the subject here, this is not about the rapture, this is his return to set up the kingdom. That's the return he's talking about. When he comes for his church, will he find faith?
During the rapture, he will.
Yes, when he comes back to get his church, will he find faith? How do you know that?
Because he gave faith to the church.
Because he gave faith to the church, exactly. Can you prove that?
Scripture.
Yes, exactly. The book of Hebrews says that Jesus Christ is the author and finisher of, in italics, the word our has been stuck in there. It's not supposed to be there. It says he is the author and finisher of faith. He is the agency through which faith is given to certain people. Paul then would write in the book of Ephesians, Ephesians 2:8, by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourself. And people have argued about what the that in that sentence is. Something before the word that is not of yourself, it is a gift of God. But in the Greek construction, it is the whole phrase. Salvation by grace through faith is the that the word that is referring to. Did you follow that? That's good. Salvation by grace through faith, that is not of yourself. It is a gift of God. So faith is a gift of God. If God is going to be saving some people, and we know he is, if he is coming back for a church, and he is, if there is going to be a church to come and get, and there will be, it's only because they are saved by the grace of God through the faith that he has given them. So when he comes back for his church, will he find faith?
Yes,
it's axiomatic. He has to. So then can this be talking about the return of Christ for his church? No, because there's been no death, burial, or resurrection yet. So don't let any preacher pull that one out and shove it on you. Now, of course, if you're an Arminian thinker and you say that it's up to you to exercise your faith and it's up to you to rev up your faith and you believe the passage that says that before Christ comes, there's going to be a falling away first and then that man of sin will be revealed. Well, you can put those two ideas together and come up with, well, Jesus even said when he comes back, there won't be any faith. And it even says that there's going to be a falling away before he comes back. And next thing you know, he's got everybody feeling guilty over the fact that they aren't able to sustain and rev up their own faith long enough for Christ to come back, and he'll come back and find no faith in the land or on the earth and blah, blah, blah. None of that theology is in the Bible anywhere. That's called mixing and matching, starting with presuppositions and letting your traditions read the scripture for you. What we know for sure is when Christ comes back for his church, he will find faith because he is the author and finisher of the faith of his own. And salvation by grace through faith is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. All of that is true, and it's not what he's talking about in Luke 18. He's talking about when he comes back to set up the kingdom, to avenge Israel against all their enemies, will he at that point find any faith in the world? After the church is gone and he comes back, will he find faith? Now let's talk about that word faith for a moment too. He can't be talking about confidence in the death, burial, and resurrection for salvation when he uses the word faith there. Right? Because it hasn't happened yet. That whole theology has not been developed yet. Paul has not been converted yet. What we know is the New Testament has not been written yet. Up till now, these people walking and talking with Jesus still believe that salvation is based in the works of the law of Moses, do good things, do enough right stuff. He has begun to shift their focus, but he still hasn't at this point even been to the Passover to say, this is my body, this is my blood, do this in remembrance of me. He hasn't even shifted their focus yet to, I am the Passover lamb, any of that yet. Do you understand what I'm saying? So what faith can he possibly be talking about here? He can only be talking about faith in everything this parable includes, which is the confidence that God will avenge Israel of their enemies. That's the context. So he's saying, when I come back to avenge Israel of their enemies, will there be any Israelites still praying, still confident, still believing God that he will avenge, even though he bears long with them? In context, that's the only faith he can be talking about. You got that? I say all that to say, don't let any preacher pull that out of context and make you feel guilty with it. Because out in California, Tom and I had that one pounded on us many, many times. Jesus even said, when he comes back, will he find faith in the land? Because it was up to you to rev up your faith and choose to have faith and take the leap of faith and have faith in your faith. And if Jesus came back and found you actively faithing, you were saved by the fact that you had faith. And that's what he meant when he said, when I come back, will I find faith in the earth? It's not at all what he meant. That's a completely atextual representation of what he's saying. Do you follow me?
And give me money to show your faith.
And give me money to show your faith. Exactly right. Exactly right. So that's the kind of damage that's done when you take a verse totally out of its context. Jesus could not possibly be speaking of saving faith in his death, burial, and resurrection when he spoke, when I return, will I find faith on the earth? He's saying, will I find anyone still anticipating the reality that God will avenge his elect Israel? And by the way, I have to point out that there are plenty of people in the church world who will tell you that Jesus is not coming back to avenge Israel or to set up his kingdom. Even among the church world, they seem to have forgotten the point of that parable. That parable is, You keep asking, you keep going back, you keep praying, you keep anticipating, because God will keep his promises to his elect. And if he's going to keep his promises to his elect, then every Old Testament promise to Israel is still valid. And therefore, amillennialism, doesn't work. So there you go. All right, we're moving on. Verse 9. And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous, and they despised others. So this is about self-righteousness, which is a natural tendency of human flesh. A natural tendency of human flesh is to believe that God is going to accept you on the basis of your goodness, of your good works. The most universal factor in all religion in the world, and back in my college days, I spent some time in comparative religion, and the most common factor in all religions in the world, with the single exception of genuine Christianity, as opposed to offshoots of Christianity, but genuine biblical Christianity stands separate from every other religion that has ever appeared on the face of planet Earth in the history of humans. It stands distinct in that all other religions say that you get whatever reward that religion offers, whether it's nirvana, whether it's reaching the that that is behind all that, whether it is getting out of the karmic wheel of life, whatever their vision and version of heaven is, you accomplish it by doing enough good. Every religion on the planet says that, except Christianity. Because every religion in the world except Christianity is man-made. And naturally, human beings would think in terms of right, wrong, good, bad, do good, get the reward. Man-made religion glorifies the flesh and its ability to do stuff, do things, do good. Man-made fleshly thought would naturally raise up man-made flesh and say man-made flesh has the capacity to do good and therefore earn a reward, and will create their religion around that. Only Christianity, biblical Christianity, unique among all the religions of the world, is the concept that your goodness can't help you. That your goodness is, in fact, only serving to raise up your flesh and your ego and your pride, all of which is in the process of condemning you. You got that? The more you trust in yourself, the less hope you have of heaven. Only Christianity says that. All world religions say good people get the reward, bad people get punished, whatever their idea of reward and punishment is. Only Christianity says good people, self-sufficient people, prideful, arrogant, do-good people go to hell. Bad people, sinners, go to heaven. It's completely counterintuitive to fleshly thought. Only Christianity says you are saved by the act of will, decision-making, and accomplishments of God on your behalf, and you can't do anything to influence or change the will of God, who has already determined out of sinful mankind to save some for his own glory. Only Christianity says that. Every other religion says everybody's got a shot. Everybody starts out equal. It's like a race. You run for all you're worth. And if you're strong enough, good enough, powerful enough, righteous enough, holy enough, have enough good works, crop up enough good stuff, you pass purgatory and go right to Mary's side. Every man-made religion has that kind of thinking in it. I'm glad you caught my reference. Only biblical Christianity says your good works, your righteousness, filthy rags, means nothing. Your best righteousness compared to other men, nothing, means nothing. I've done this before, but I'll draw it on the board again, because when we talk about goodness among human beings, we're talking about comparative goodness, right? We're talking about, you know, if I have a couple of month period where I do a lot of good stuff, a lot of charitable work, I'm really knocking myself out. And during that same period, Jeff goes on a drunken binge. It's all beer and women for Jeff, and he's just going to, you know. I decide to pick Jeff because it's like the most unlikely, but.
Thanks.
Yeah,
I was going to say.
Okay, Jim, you just get to pick.
I know what I'm doing. Huh? Let's say I have a really good couple of months and Jeff has a rather depraved couple of months. People would look at us and compare the two of us and say, my, Jim's doing good. Good compared to what? Well, compared to Jeff. Look how bad Jeff's doing. So we could say, well, you know, here's Jim and here's Jeff under him in the holiness line, you know. And then let's say like down here underneath all this is Michael Jackson, you know.
It should be way lower.
No. And then, no, I'm giving him credit here.
Whatever.
And like under that, you know, you get the Timothy McVeighs, you get your Charles Mansons, you're really working your way down here, okay? And then above this line, above the line that is me, that is the line above Jeff, you might have, say, Mother Teresa, you know, somebody might say. Mother Teresa had a life full of really good work. And then somebody would say, oh, Pope John Paul II, he was really good, you know, did a lot of good stuff. He's above Mother Teresa in this particular chart I'm knocking out of just positive good works. And so if you look at the distance between the lowest guy here, who I decided was Charles Manson, and the Pope, who was, you know, at the top line right here, you could say, well, compared to everybody in between, Mother Teresa and the Pope are doing really good up here, you know? But the problem is, Charles Manson and the Pope are not the standard. I just used Charles Manson and the Pope in the same sentence.
Nobody else did that.
Comparatively. And no one else did that this morning. Charles Manson and the Pope are not the standard. The standard is God, and I can't draw the line on this board for God because that line has to be infinitely high above the earth to where heaven is. If I could reach the throne of God, I would draw the line there. And I would say, now there's the standard. So when you see the distance between, say, Charles Manson and the Pope, it becomes infinitesimal compared to the distance between the Pope and the throne of God. You understand what I'm saying? So all of our works as human beings fall into one great big lump, no matter who you are, and no matter how good those works were, they all fall into one great big lump that is not as good as God.
And who you keep referencing, Paul, I would say he's definitely above maybe Pope John Paul.
Right. Oh,
we'll put
Paul above Pope John Paul. You're right. And he said, I'm the chiefest of sinners. Right?
And what you've been saying about filthy rags. You know, it's all
and filthy rags, right. Absolutely. He lumped himself in with detestable humanity, who was saved by grace through the election of God. So all man-made religion uses this as the comparative standard and says, well, this guy did better than that guy, therefore that guy deserves a reward and that guy deserves punishment. Only Christianity says there's none good. There's none righteous. No, not one. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. There is none that seeketh God. No, not one. And that includes Paul, and that includes the Pope. And that includes Charles Manson and everybody in between. All of humanity, Paul says, they have all become unprofitable. All. Of all religion in the history of the world, only Christianity says all mankind is sinful, detestable, has nothing to recommend itself, and so God must be the mover, because man is incapable of moving adequately to obligate God to save them. Therefore, if anyone gets saved, it has to be God that made the move. It has to be God that saves men, because men are incapable of saving themselves. Do you understand that? Okay, well, that's the point of the next parable. He spoke this parable unto certain who trusted in themselves that they were righteous, and they despised others. By the way, people who think they're righteous, especially self-righteous people, that is the very next step. They despise others. Have you ever run into that in your life? These self-righteous folks who think they're good, think they're right, They are not merciful to those who fall. Self-righteous people can't wait to see somebody in trouble so that they can point at them and step on them and say, well, look at that bad person. If I can recognize how bad they are, clearly I must be quite good. Right? Here's the parable. Two men went up into the temple to pray. The one was a Pharisee, and the other was a publican. What's a publican?
Tax collector.
Who was he collecting taxes from?
Hebrews.
From Jews, from Israelites. And who was he giving the tax money to?
Rome.
To Rome. He was taking taxes from his own people to give to Rome, and almost invariably, they were lining their own pockets, overtaxing their people because the common person on the street didn't know what the appropriate taxes from Rome were. And so the publicans could often say, new tax, new tax. You got to pay the new tax. There's one point where Jesus enters into a city, and actually it's funny because it's a city in Galilee where he supposedly grew up, and he's made to pay a stranger's tax. But anytime somebody would enter from anywhere, you know, oh, you don't belong in the city. Tax, tax, a lot of taxing going on. And then since you didn't know how much of that money was going to Rome, you had to pay the publican, one of your own people, however much money they were demanding on the taxes, and then he would go pay Rome what was appropriate, and the publicans continued to get quite rich. By the way, one of the apostles was a publican. Do you remember who?
Matthew.
Matthew was a tax collector. Hated among the Jews. So Jesus is out there getting the popular people to follow him. Fishermen and publicans. That's how you start a movement right there. Two men went up into the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, a legalist, one who would say, I always do everything right. And the other was a publican, a sinner. And the Pharisee stood and prayed thus of himself. Jesus took the time to say, now when he prayed about himself, which is very interesting. I thank you that I am not as other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I've heard people pray that way. And they think that because they're giving God the credit, you know, God made me this good, so I'm really giving God the credit. But I'm giving him the credit for how good he's made me. Me, me, me. And I'm not like other people who are extortioners, unjust, adulterers. See, he's doing that very thing we were talking about. That one of the ways that he's trying to prove to himself that he's good is that he's recognizing the faults of other people. Other people are extortioners. That's another way of saying, I'm not. Other people are adulterers. That's another way of saying, I'm not. Therefore, I have all this good stuff I can rev up about myself. I fast twice in the week, and I give tithes of all that I possess. I've always been surprised that people who teach tithing virtually never use that verse.
And it's in the New Testament.
And it's in the New Testament. You'd think they'd be jumping all over it. I mean, this guy is justifying himself before God by the fact that he tithes. Don't you want to be justified before God? That's about as twisted as the other versions of tithing teaching I've heard. I tithe of everything I possess. And the publican, meanwhile, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes unto heaven. Which means that the Pharisee had to have been praying, head up, eyes toward heaven, arms out, me. Thank you, God, and I'm not like them. And you can see the body language in the words that are being used. And then he points out that the publican didn't even feel himself worthy to lift his eyes toward heaven. That means he had his head down. And he smote upon his breast, beating himself in his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, I am a sinner. So the contrast is somebody going to God and saying, I did good and I didn't do bad, versus the publican coming and saying to God, have mercy on me, I'm a sinner. And there's nobody on planet Earth who is not a sinner. And genuine Christianity, that's also why in the Remonstrance and in the Synod of Dort, in the 5 points of Calvinism, that they start right out with total depravity. The key element in everything else you need to know about salvation and your need for a Savior has to start with, I'm a sinner. And that's where so much of Christianity falls flat or comes up short, is that they don't start by telling their people, because they don't want to give them the unpopular news, that you're a sinner and that before God there is none righteous and there is no one that does good and there is no one that seeks God. You have to start with you're depraved and you're a sinner before you will ever ask for mercy. And notice that the publican was not in any way talking about anything about himself or appealing to God on the basis of his righteousness or his worthiness. All he was looking for was mercy from God, as opposed to the Pharisee who was saying, I deserve because I'm good. So Jesus says, I tell you, this man, the publican, went down to his house justified. Interesting word. It has at its root DK, righteous, justice. He went down to his house justified. Now, who justified him? Did he justify himself? How did he go to his house justified? Where did his justification come from? It wasn't from his works. It wasn't from his acts. Where did his justification come from? From God. The justification came from God. And Christ was being very clear to say here, this man went down to his house justified, which is something only God would know. Who among the two was justified? And Christ here is saying, this man is justified, proving to these people that justification does not come by good works and merit. Justification comes by the mercy and grace of God. That's a very important element that only Christianity, again, I'm going to say unique among all the religions of the history of the world, only Christianity says that you will be justified, made right before God by an action God takes on your behalf. That your good works, the beneficial things you do, will not justify you in the court of heaven, even if you participate in the fall of communism. Those good works will not get you justified before God. Only God in his mercy justifies sinners. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone that exalts himself shall be abased, brought down. Everyone who lifts himself up will be brought down. And if God wants to bring you down, how far down can God bring you? Yeah, way down, said Elizabeth. Yeah, we're talking hell. We're talking lake of fire. God can take you way down. And everyone who exalts himself, this is Jesus talking, listen to him. Everyone who exalts himself, and he gives the demonstration of what the exaltation of yourself is. It's preaching your works, talking about your good works, talking about what you did, trying to justify yourself before God and obligate God to give you heaven forever on the basis of what you did. That's what Jesus called exalting yourself. And everyone who exalts himself after that manner, and I'm sorry, but that is precisely what Rome teaches you to do. Rome teaches you to accumulate good works. If you do a bad work, you do penances to erase those bad works. And when you get to heaven, Peter's going to take your good works and your bad works, and he's going to weigh them out on that scale. And as long as it tips slightly toward the good, you're in. And if you don't make it, then you get to go to purgatory for a little while, where you serve off the rest of your sins by suffering more to get rid of more of your sin until you're finally good enough to go before the God of heaven. That is the theology of Rome. It is all about you exalting yourself. And Jesus Christ himself said, despite what the, quote, vicar of Christ may say, Jesus said, everyone who approaches God that way will be abased.
And the Pope, the head of this church that preaches this, that you got to do all this stuff and go to purgatory, he is so good that he even gets to bypass.
He's bypassing purgatory. That's what they said.
That has purgatory.
Absolutely.
He gets to bypass it. He's so good.
But that statement wasn't just that he was going to bypass purgatory, but that he would go straight to the side of Mary. Because he has done so much to advance the cause of Mary during his papacy. Right to the side of Mary. I don't need Mary. I don't need the Pope. I'm looking forward to the head of the church I belong to appearing in the clouds of heaven, and there'll be a trumpet and a voice saying, come up hither, and I'm either coming out of my grave or I'm instantaneously changed, and I'm going to go and be with his side, so will we ever be with the Lord. No mention of Mary in there. I don't dislike Mary, but I don't need her. I've got the Lord. That's all I need. Everyone who tries to justify himself that way will be abased. Every man who exalts himself shall be abased. And he that humbles himself shall be, he used the exact same word, exalted. So there are your options. You can either try to lift yourself up and say how good, right, holy you are, and God will put you down because God's going to get all the glory. But if you can approach God like this publican did and say, have mercy on me, not only will he have mercy and keep you out of hell, but he will exalt you all the way to the kingdom of heaven. And if God determines to exalt you, how much exaltation can he give you? A great deal. A great deal. And so, again, what we're talking about here is human beings who are going to leave this planet, and everybody who's been here leaves, and everybody who is here now leaves, and everybody dies, and everybody is going to stand before the judge of heaven and earth. And will not the judge of all creation do what is right? Yes, he will. He will do what is just, and it will be driven by his holiness. And his holiness is going to demand that nobody stand in his presence and talk about what they did. Have we not driven out demons in your name? Have we not cast out demons? Have we not done great works in your name? Have we not prophesied in your name? Have we not done? Even though they say, we did it in your name. We did it for you. His response is, I will say to them, I never knew you. Depart from me. Your works are iniquity. That's the point. Your works are iniquity. No matter how good the works of a sinner are relative to other sinners, it's still sinners doing sinful work. The most obvious example of our depravity and the depth of our sinfulness is that we don't recognize how sinful we truly are. And that even if we do relatively good works compared to other sinners, those are still not holy works compared to the holy righteousness of God. We're all sinners among sinners doing sinful works. And none of those sinful works are good enough to get us an everlasting righteousness and justification with God. You will only stand before God forever and be exalted if he does it out of mercy, grace, and kindness with no deserving basis on your part. There's a sentence in there somewhere. He will do it on the basis of his grace, and he will do it on the basis of his mercy without you deserving anything at all. All you deserve is his condemnation. All you deserve is for him to send you out of his sight altogether forever. See, the other thing that people don't understand, long as what people don't understand about sin is that sin is not linear. It is cumulative. Here's what I mean. People think that if you live like a sinner till you're like, let's say, 34, I'm picking that number randomly. If there's anybody who is suddenly doing better at 34, I'm not picking on you. But let's say you live a sinful, depraved life till 34, and then at 34, suddenly you say, that's it. I'm going to do good now. I'm going to do better. I'm going to be a Christian. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to do good things now. I'm going to help the poor and feed the hungry. And I'm going to do good works now from this point forward. The thinking is, the religious, fleshly, sinful, religious thinking of the world is, now that you're doing good, as long as you die in that process of now I'm doing some good, you die a good person. But your whole life is on trial. And if you do bad up till 34 and then do good till 36 and die at 36 in a car crash, people will go, oh, well, he was just doing so good. Oh, well, he'll go to heaven because he was a good guy right there toward the end. No, it's cumulative. And the point is, a miss is as good as a mile. Paul said that if you in any way offend one point of the law, you're guilty of the whole law. So if you ever sinned at any point in your life, That's sufficient to make you eternally guilty before God forever, even though you do some good things along the way. We humans like to remember the good stuff. Well, I did some good stuff. Fed somebody, gave somebody some clothes one time. I could ask any of you right now, tell me some good things you've done in your life. You could tell me. You could reel them off. I did so, because we remember the good stuff. If I said, tell me some really bad, wicked, depraved things you did, you'd go, well, kind of hard to do, because you try to blot that stuff out of our memory to try to convince ourselves that we're doing good and we're good people and we're going to heaven and we're going to be okay. It's the way the flesh works. But the fact is, if you've ever sinned once, you're eternally guilty. Sin is cumulative, it is not linear. You have this whole cumulative sinful life to deal with. Only the mercy of God is sufficient to justify you. And he justifies his people, who he just called his elect. He justifies his elect, and those people go to heaven by his grace and mercy, and everyone else gets exactly what they deserve, regardless of where they fall in this spectrum or how many good works they did while they were here. You get that? Now, that rankles our flesh. That rankles human psychology. It makes us go, no, but that doesn't seem fair. Shouldn't good people go to heaven? Shouldn't people who do good things and go their whole life, shouldn't good people go to heaven? Nope. Know why? It's no good people. Bible says there's no good people. Read those books, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. I always laugh at those titles, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. The answer to that is, why do bad things happen to good people? They deserve it. That's why bad things happen. Bad things happen because they deserve it, because there are no good people. So, if you've got no good people, let me keep extrapolating here, you've got a whole planet full of people and none of them are good, and then they form a religion, of course they're going to form a religion that convinces them that they are good. Right? Only Christianity, unique among all the religions of the world, is bold enough and honest enough to say, no, you're not. Get off your high horse. Stop the Pharisaical, self-righteous, self-justifying attitude. Admit that you're a sinner. Get on your face and ask God for mercy. That's the path to salvation. That's the path to eternal life. In your flesh dwells no good thing. The flesh, according to Christ, profits nothing. I mean, how many times does the Bible say this kind of stuff? And yet we keep thinking, well, flesh, 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 flesh. And there's been so much of it on the TV these last couple of days in talking about John Paul II. They will say, but look at his works, look at his works, look at the things he did, look at the stuff he did, look at the stuff he did. Yes, he did do those things. And they amount to nothing. In the court of heaven, all his cumulative good works add up to filthy, bloody rags. And if he ends up in heaven, I'm not his judge. There is one that will judge him and determine his salvation. If he ends up in heaven, it will be by the same way Jeff or Jennifer or me or Charlie or Tom or anybody else ends up in heaven. We will be there by the mercy and grace of God, who determined before the foundation of the world that we would end up in his presence. And there isn't a thing you can do that is going to make God impressed enough to say, well, I'm moving you up on this list here. I'm putting you're up here somewhere. You're really moving now. You understand all that? That's the point of this parable. He compared two men, one who tried to justify himself and one who got down on his face, wouldn't even raise his eyes and said, have mercy on me, a sinner. And one of those men went home justified, and it was the one who looked for mercy. You got that? Okay, I'll wrap up there. It was, I have to point out, it was interesting timing that just going through Luke as we were, verse by verse, that showed up the day after the Pope died. It's just impossible to ignore the providential appearance of that parable right there. So, personally, just so you know, now that I've said the things I've said, I hope God has mercy on John Paul II, because I don't wish for the damnation of anybody, because I have some sense out of this Bible what that means. And I can't possibly bring myself to hope for the damnation of anybody. But short of the mercy of God, John Paul and nobody else has any hope. You understand that? All right.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.